Welcome to the 25th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Jesse Gitzman-Burke. Co-hosting with me is our lich-like troubadour, Lester Crowe, and his strolling bones. Say hi, Lester.
Hi, Lester.
We are also joined by Jordan Bloody Sunboy Steelman and Layla Fridge Gargoyle Miranova. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello. Are you Ronery? Oh, we can't make fun of Kim Jong-il anymore, can we?
No, he's gone.
Or did the door open wide?
Now? We need, like, what, 21 years or something before?
That was something like that, right? I mean, his son's not that much better, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, how's everybody been?
You good?
So has anybody been up to anything really exciting over the last 2 weeks since our last episode before we hop right into the news?
I got a brand new camcorder, so I'm going to start making some videos about Warhammer because I like it so much. And I've actually played my first game in quite some time.
Yeah, that was the one that you were actually getting ready to start during our last episode, right?
Yeah, literally, as soon as we finished doing it, I went recording the episode. That is, we went. I went downstairs and finished helping one of my friends make a character, and then we got stuck in. It was pretty good.
So what did you guys play, and how did it go?
So my girlfriend Jenny, she built a witch. She's really good at making characters, and
anybody who listened to the podcast might remember Jenny from, she was in the
Gathering Storm.
The Gathering Storm game that Paul had GM'd for us.
She played Freda Krueger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Krueger, that's right.
Yeah, because Freddy Krueger was her grandfather. And she was a bounty hunter, but she created, in this recent game we played, she created a witch because she wanted to explore the mechanics of that and like magic. And it's kind of like a pretty good starting place for magic users. And then she also wants to try to become a necromancer because there's a chaos spell. Basically, a witch allows you to use any of the dark magic or chaos spell abilities. In fact, you can use any of the magic abilities as a witch. And that was kind of her shtick. And then this friend of mine that I've met recently, he created, He created a female, I think it's a bounty hunter or something like that. Oh, no.
Now, did you guys draw careers or did you have people choose what they wanted?
I just let them make what characters they want because I find that it's easier for them to motivate themselves as far as what they want their character to be like when they get to pick. With more advanced or like when I play with people who've played role-playing games before, I do kind of prefer a more random generation. But when it comes to new players, I definitely prefer them to kind of be comfortable with the characters that they play. I can't remember exactly. I think he's a grave robber. I'm pretty sure he's a grave robber. I'll correct myself in the comments if that's wrong. And she's a witch. And then my other friend he made an iron breaker, but the story is that he's a little cracked. He's a little insane. So that's why he's with this witch and this grave robber. And they ended up getting into some problems with some zombies because my one friend is a zombie survivalist.
You know, actually I found doing a zombie game for people who haven't played before to be a really easy way. It fits in the Warhammer lore very easily. And, you know, you can do a very quick and easy adventure about, you know, hey, everybody's in a tavern and zombies attack. And you don't even need to come up with a story. It's just kind of a one-off fun adventure that everybody just kind of inherently understands as maybe an icebreaker into the lore.
Well, they were walking down a twisted path and came across an abandoned wagon and then got charged by zombies. And the friend who's being the grave robber, he actually shot my girlfriend's character in the leg accidentally. Mm-hmm. It was pretty funny.
So, we've been doing a lot of character creation, gearing up for some new campaigns and adventures. We started off the Horror at Hugeldahl episode number 2. So I made, you know, my amethyst wizard or apprentice who's playing in that game. But Layla, you're also joining Michael Wilson's campaign, which was which is starting up in about a week or two. And so you kind of went through the character creation process, creating another new character, not Helga, kind of like something.
An actual character.
what are your problems with Helga, and why do you kind of feel the disconnect.
Well, in creating this new character that I'm actually pretty excited about, we actually went through and made a background for her, like an entire background story of why she is where she is currently and like what she's doing and why. And I felt like in setting up that background, suddenly this whole motivation problem that I've been having with Helga, like, melted away, because I knew exactly what her motivation was all of a sudden. So I just thought it was really interesting, kind of abiding by storytelling principles. Like, I have found a way to not have a problem that I was having before with motivation.
So for those unfamiliar with Helga's, or your personal struggles with Helga's motivation, can you kind of give everybody a refresher?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Helga has no motivation. I mean, like, she's just this stubborn character that kind of, like, got, I don't know, plopped down out of nowhere into this world that she has no idea, like, what she's doing in it or why she's there. And so, ultimately, like, every time the dwarves get set on a quest or whatever, she's like, well, I don't want to do that because why am I doing it? I don't have any reason to. And so, she just has a really hard time, like, figuring out why she's even part of the game, essentially.
I find it interesting the disconnect between, like, I totally get what you're saying and I appreciate it. And it's that concept on some level, and I think probably to a lot of our listeners, is really, really foreign, even though it's totally belongs, is because most RPG guys are just like, well, I have a quest. That is my purpose. You know, oh, there's somebody in danger. I'm going to go save them. That's my quest.
Right.
And we just take it at face value and go with it. Now, it's a lot more fun when there's more depth to it. And you're obviously not satisfied with, here's a cash reward, go do this.
No.
Or here's somebody in danger, go fix it. Here's a town in trouble, make it better.
Right.
And it's I think it's kind of a, maybe of elevating the role-playing aspects to the next level. And I'm actually really enjoying kind of exploring that. I mean, I mean everybody, all the other dwarves obviously are perfectly content with, oh, you'll pay me 2 gold to go on this adventure, that's fine.
Yeah, I like literally cannot comprehend how they just say okay to like every single little quest that comes up, you know. Like, I think I think it was in the one that was just posted recently, the horror Hugo Doll, yeah, where my character Helga was handed some money by one of the guys that we saved on the road to go bury, you know, the people that were left on the road. And Helga's just thinking, like, well, what do I need to do that for? Like, I don't know these people. Like, can we just get onto the town? I didn't even want to stop to, like, save the people in peril. And it was pointed out to me that the road was very narrow and we couldn't get by, but even that wasn't enough because Helga's just like, I don't care, I don't want to save these people, can we keep going?
But Helga's like very much at this point now, like, I'm gonna try and survive this madness around me and hopefully not get myself killed by the people I sort of feel now obligated to protect.
It's not even a survival thing. It's just apathy. She's like, I don't care to be involved in any of these things, so can I just move along with my life? So, but my new character doesn't suffer from this problem, so I'm kind of excited.
So, Jordan, what have you been up to?
Well, kind of like Lester was saying, and I mentioned in the last episode, I think that it's been a long time since I've been gaming. You know, holidays kind of destroyed my gaming. So, but the Saturday we actually played the first. Got back into the Warhammer campaign for the first time in like over 2 months. So that was a lot of fun.
And that's the one you're GMing, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and we just, Saturday we just wrapped up, we managed to wrap up Mistaken Identity, which is like the introductory adventure to the Empire Within campaign. And
The Empire Within, is that the second edition adventure, or is that the first
one? The first edition.
Okay, that's the one I never played that one, but I've heard really good things about that.
Yeah, it's going pretty well so far. Of course, you know, it's all written for first edition rules, so I'm basically just kind of doing things from the seat of my pants. I'm just kind of converting things on the fly, which really isn't that difficult.
Yeah, I did it with some second edition books and had no problem.
Yeah, it's actually gone really easily. dealt out, well, I guess maybe it's not technically my first. I dealt out my the first critical wound in a long time to the apothecary. He took a crossbow bolt to the temple, and it almost gouged his eye out.
Oh, you almost headshot him?
Yeah, no, it wasn't quite that bad, but he got, I can't remember the name of it, but he got something like some eye injury that was like a 4 severity, and now he takes two misfortune dice for anything related to sight.
What's that? Sounds like what our dwarf has in the in our other game.
Yeah.
So, my favorite is the flesh wound, the flavor of flesh wound. The more flesh wounds you have, the more severe it becomes.
Yeah.
It's only a flesh wound.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that everybody's now, like, after the holidays, everybody's jumped back in full speed. Everybody's got different games going, so we've got a lot of activity to discuss now and a lot of real-world examples. And I'm really excited, Jordan, that you're running the some first edition content, because we've talked in the past about up converting the rule systems from second edition or those adventures. Right. And, came up with some pretty simple and easy ways to do that. And at some point in the future, it's probably worth revisiting the first edition stuff as well and see, you know, what kind of difficulties or even what happens really easily for you in that process.
Right. Yeah. And I ran to the first adventure that I ran for this group was another first edition adventure, which was, out of the core book. What was the name of it? The Oldenhaller Contract. So yeah, this would be the second.
That's a nice one. Actually, I've never played that one, but I've read it a few times. Uh-huh. It sounded cool.
Yeah, it's pretty good. There's a couple of hammy parts to it that, you know, any good GM kind of knows when to use the box text and when not to. But it was actually, overall, it was a really good adventure. My players don't know it, but they apathy, they kind of screwed themselves because they allowed something nasty to be let loose in the sewers of Nuln, and now they're reaping the ill-gotten rewards from that.
So. Well, so we've all received a nice little bit of news via the website at Fantasy Flight last week. I believe it was on Thursday. They put an announcement out for a new product called Faith of Sigmar. And what this really is a
booster pack.
Is their first foray, yeah, a booster pack, I guess you could call it. But it's their first foray for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay into this print-on-demand service. And do you guys want to talk a little bit about what that is and why it's significant?
Well, should we touch on what the actual product is first and then discuss, sure, like what print on demand is?
Sure. Yeah. It kind of goes hand in hand. So yeah, go ahead. And,
well, what I understand, I don't know exactly how many cards. I believe there's 17 cards in the pack. It could be wrong. There's like an item card. There's a rules card or a couple rules cards. And then you've got like 10 or something like that. Different blessings in it, and they're all,
I count 20, but yeah,
there's
20 total cards, 17 of which are actual cards.
Oh, okay.
For play, and the other three are either rules or cover art and things like that.
Yeah, and they're ranks 1 to 5, and they're all blessings for Sigmar.
And it's only Sigmar, right? Yeah. So that's, you know,
well, so I mean that orders. That makes sense, because now, you know, they'll do the Bright Order and they'll do all, you know, all the orders of magic, all the faiths, I'm assuming. I mean, I would but, assume,
yeah, that's certainly plan. Something we should talk about, because this the introduction of this print on demand service, which we'll get into in a minute, potentially changes the way that we'll be seeing certain types of content going forward.
Well, I actually think it's a good idea, because you know how on the forums, when there's a lapse in interest or announcements, people tend to get really like concerned, like the game is dying or they're going into a new edition or whatever. And I think this model, if they start consistently releasing these new packs, and I'm assuming that they have them designed probably at least for all the different orders, if not for the faiths and the orders. And, you know, you could put in combat cards and all that kind of stuff too.
Well, let's touch a little bit more on what it is. It includes ranks 1 through 5 blessings for Sigmar priests. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, it includes a couple item cards, and I don't recall if there might even be an action card or two as well. So effectively, it's a booster pack for priests of Sigmar specifically. So it's picking one very specific career in the whole lot of 50 or 60 some odd careers and giving them, you know, a content pack.
Mm-hmm.
So ostensibly that means that we're going to see similar products going forward for other popular, I'm assuming it's going to be by popularity or something like that. Cause I don't think they're going to do all the faiths first and then do all the orders and then pick alternatives.
It would make sense.
But you know, I would venture to guess the next one we're going to see is the Bright Wizard pack, just because Priest of Sigmar and Bright Wizards are kind of the two staples of priest and magic use. But I think the obvious concept here is that they're going to go through the orders and the faiths. But that's, you know, so that's something like, what, 12 or 16 booster packs. But, you know, let's take it a step further. What else could you do with these booster pack products?
They could do item cards. They could do location cards. Pretty much.
I'd love a location pack. That'd be cool.
Pretty much anything. I mean, I don't know what the feasibility of them printing the smaller cards really is. I don't know how that would work.
That's an interesting point, yeah, because this example here is only the full-size cards.
Yeah, because they could print new critical wound cards and stuff like that. No, but I mean, it makes more sense to just go with the standard size cards.
What if they, you know, they could also do things... I was going to say a monster pack. You could have a whole greenskin deck or an undead deck or a Tomb Kings deck for some of those more obscure cards.
But that's actually what I'm actually kind of hoping we'll see, you know, kind of theme pack type things, you know, like a WoW pack or something with some extra orcs and goblins in action, you know, specific greenskin cards.
Wood elf specific cards for players, dwarf specific stuff like that.
You know, actually, I hadn't considered it, Lester, but you probably just hit on exactly what's going to happen here. I'm thinking now, those races that don't need their full books anymore, or those, you know, like the two races that are going to get introduced in Heroes Call are not going to get their own standalone supplements like all the other races are going to get. They're kind of sharing the glory with a lot of the other content that comes in Heroes Call. They can be flushed out through booster packs now.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, if somebody wants Dark Elves or somebody, or maybe even the High Elf book, then that Wood Elf book, those ones that people aren't really sure what's going to happen with them, you know, maybe they're going to get flushed out through booster packs now and they're going to be working on adventures instead. Or maybe they can get that product to market sooner. I was also thinking, you know, you could provide booster packs for martial careers. Like here's a bunch of, you know, fancy dwarven technology. People are wondering, well, how are we going to expand on runes for the dwarves and all their inventions and stuff like that? Well, this is going to be how it's going to. It's not going to be in another box set. It's going to be in something like this.
It makes more sense moving forward, I think. And then, like you say, the only big expansions you need to do would either be adventures or fleshing out other major portions of the world, like, you know, they've done chaos.
Cards that were misprinted or eradicated? Oh, yeah,
they have to do that. That has been, people have been asking about that for so long, and that should, I think personally, if you can provide proof of purchase, they should just give the people.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Obviously, you know, for obvious reasons, but I think they should, regardless of that, though, they should offer you the correct cards, if you will. I don't really have a problem. I'm like Paul if I want to write on the card, I will, and I really don't feel a need to. But I think that this is what they'll do, is to sate everybody's desire for spoilers and for announcements. They're going to announce these things at a pretty regular clip, and then we'll probably see, like you said, maybe two or three other major products this year, like boxed products.
So we're thinking these will kind of come maybe one in between each product or two?
Yeah, one or two. Maybe once a month, maybe once every 3 weeks they'll do an announcement of this. I mean, it all depends on how far ahead they are. Maybe they're just testing the water too, right?
One of the neat things was this Faith of Sigmar, which I think was about $7 or $8.
It's $6.95, but then you have to pay shipping.
Sure. So, but I mean, it's not – we'll get into the cost and stuff in a second, but
it's a big concern.
They announced it and it was available to purchase right away.
Yeah.
That was kind of cool. I mean, this print on demand service is effectively a new model, which they've used in a couple of their other games to bring to market what would otherwise be uncost effective amounts of cards or products that wouldn't sell enough to be worth producing.
Oh, yeah.
And they, so what they're doing is they're printing them in these small batches. And they do even make a comment. It's a different printing process than what they're doing for all the other cards. So they even do make a little disclosure at the bottom, which says, due to variations in the printing process, cards from print-on-demand expansions will be subtly different in appearance and texture from base game cards.
I put the game cards in play in sleeves anyway, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a very minute point, but it does mean that there's going to be. I hope that doesn't mean they're going to be of lesser quality. I hope it means they're still.
I have a feeling.
You know, I don't even know what to expect. We'll find out soon.
I have a feeling they won't be as thick as the cards.
That was what I was worried about. I think I'm sure the print quality will be fine. I was worried more about the paper quality.
They've just got a bunch of. They have a bunch of laser printers lashed together in the basement of Fantasy Flight Games, and they're just printing them off, cutting them up, and sending them to you.
Well, cool. So tell me what you guys think. We've got Lester, Jordan, you guys both are playing the game. I own everything that's been produced so far for the game. And now I'm seeing booster packs going out the door at $10 a pop, and I know that there's about 25 of these on the horizon.
I wait, personally.
With a lot of content that's arguably duplicates of what I already have, but the completionist in me feels compelled to buy them. How do you guys feel about this doubling up on purchasing?
Well, I think it all depends on the model. Like, if they go back and print other cards like you were suggesting for people, like everything that's been printed since they released the vaults and the guides, if they go back and print all the cards or put them available for print on demand, I wouldn't worry about purchasing anything like that. But any of the stuff
you look at this booster pack, it's not all new content. It's not 15 new spells.
Isn't it?
Is it?
I mean, I don't know. Is it?
I was under the impression that it was 15 or 17 new abilities for
that's what I thought too.
Okay, well, maybe I misread. I beg your pardon. Faith of Sigmar introduces 15 new blessings and 2 new items full of Righteous Wrath.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm happier with that.
And what I would do is I would wait for I would wait personally for all the orders to be released. It all depends on the structure, but I would wait and buy them in bulk because you do have to pay for shipping. So I think logistics of buying one and having them print it and send it to you it's just not there. I don't think I would wait until there's more products available before.
On the plus side, it does allow for if you have a group. I mean, I have in my box all the orders and all the faiths, and I only use my amethyst order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this allows, now let's reverse the order. Let's pretend I'm a PC. I only need to buy my spells.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't need to buy all 15 other ones.
Exactly.
I can just buy mine.
It works so good from a PC.
It's cost effective for the right people.
Yeah, it works for the PCs. But I mean, like, I own a lot of the content too. And I would just use the other order spells and abilities for NPCs and things like that as a game master. So I still get use out of them. It's just, I do agree from a player's perspective, this is great.
So one last bit of news, which is kind of on the side, a side note, but just a heads up for anybody who's curious. The rumor mill is churning that all the dice expansion packs are currently out of print. Everybody seems to be having a really tough time getting those, especially overseas. I think we're probably fine in the U.S. right now, but anyway, if you're just a heads up, I was hearing that on the forums today.
Good thing I have more than enough.
Yeah,
I mean, somebody brought up the problem, which was they only have the core set, and he was worried that wasn't enough to play.
Well, that's more than enough to play. You just have to share.
That's what I told him. He had just convinced all of his players that who were coming from different systems and they were all kind of in the mindset that they would have their own dice, and so I kind of suggested to him that it seems far more common and reasonable to share a dice pool or pile. To generate your pools.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And if you want your own dice, I mean, instead of going out and buying, a whole player's handbook, all you really need to do is go buy the dice. You have a community.
Well, we're right, but his problem was they were all out of print and out of stock everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. They come in the Game Master's Vault as well, right? You get dice in the Game Master's Vault and dice in the core set, plus you can buy dice separately.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, let's kick it off into a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about storytelling and character motivation.
Yes.
Ooh, meaty.
All right, we're back. So we're going to talk a bit about storytelling and character motivation. We're going to kick this section off with a special request from Aaron Mokhtar, obviously the Klingon, who writes in on Facebook, GMing my first game on the 28th, and was hoping that some of you here could give me some pointers, maybe the top three tips, advice guide, or anything for a noob GM. A lot of you listeners may recognize Aaron. He's very actively participates on the Facebook page. So get to know him. He's a fun guy.
Yeah, thanks for that too, by the way, Aaron.
Yeah, so great question. And I think we'll probably kick it off with a bit of general, you know, kind of storytelling mechanics or what, you know, Layla, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I just have some questions that I can ask of the two of you that GM, Lester and Jesse.
And Jordan.
Jordan does too.
Yeah. Oh, and Jordan does too. All right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, so the general storytelling elements are setting, character, plot, backstory, and detail, and there's a lot of all of those going on in RPGs, and I recognize them, like, I don't know, maybe more than some, because I do write, and so I'm just kind of familiar with those elements, but I think they're really interesting in RPGs, because I think when some of them are missing, you completely lose, I guess, the flow of the game, in my opinion. So as a GM, what would you say is the most important storytelling element for you?
Jordan, you want to take first crack at that?
Say that one more time so I can, while I'm kind of brewing on it.
Yeah. What's the most important storytelling element that you find drives the game forward when you're playing?
I think really when it comes down to it, it's all about the players feeling motivated to engage in the world. And then also I think the role of the game master is to kind of nudge them in the right direction, but take what the player ultimately is telling them that they're interested in, and then just kind of spinning that off into, you know, into something, you know, greater. You know, it's kind of part of the discussion, I guess, about, you know, railroading RPGs versus, you know, the sandbox RPGs and extremes between, you know, is it just the GM is telling you a story and you're just kind of following that story, or is the player supposed to be suggesting the course of action and the GM is just supposed to, you know, react to it? I think a lot of it should come from the players. But clearly, you know, the GM has an important role too.
It's interesting you should bring that up, Jordan. The we are very fortunate enough in the past couple months to partner up with Michael Wilson, who's run a series of sandbox adventures where we've just wrapped up the Underworld Rising and are getting ready to jump off into our new campaign. And he operates his games completely in a sandbox environment driven by the players. Right. Now, alternatively from that, you know, the adventures that I've run and the adventure that Chris Wagner has currently run, the Horror at Hugeldahl, those are the more railroady versions that you're talking about, where you're running the characters through a very scripted story modified, you know, then by their actions.
And it really depends on the players, because I've found that over the years that I've GM'd, and you know, when you GM with different people, you just kind of have to know your audience. So you have to know, because different players, I suppose, engage at different levels. And so you do definitely have those players that they want you to suggest a course of action, where I used to run some campaigns with players that I didn't have to do anything. All I had to do was show up for the session, and they would immediately like throw things in my face. Hey, we want to go do this. Hey, we want to go do that. And then I basically just had to kick back and let themselves get into trouble. But there, you really just have to know. And even within a group, you will tend to have you know, different player personalities. And you have to, that's, I guess, part of the responsibility of the GM is to understand that and to understand how to give everybody their proper, you know, the proper spotlight, to give them their proper time in the game so that one person's not hogging all the attention because they're the ones that are, you know, always trying to go off and do something crazy.
And as the GM, you should make sure that you're not doing that. As the GM, you should not hog the spotlight at all.
Yeah. Well, as a GM, I think the responsible thing as a GM isn't to kind of, you know, take that, you know, if you have one player who's really enthusiastic about, you know, engaging in something, you shouldn't rob them of that enthusiasm, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. clearly they're excited about something or they think something is really neat. So rather, I think where some of the subtler skills of the GM come in is that you as the GM should figure out ways to try and get the other players involved in that course of action so that you're, you know, you don't constantly have the party splitting up because this guy wants to do this thing and this guy wants to do that thing and it's on, you know, totally opposite sides of the map and have nothing to do with each other. So, but I think too, maybe the players as a group need to come to an expectation or an understanding that, you know, we're here to kind of share a, like, this is the party's story. You know, this isn't like mm-hmm. John's story and it's all about John. This is like John and all of the other guys that, you know, he travels with, you know, they have their say too. And, so, you know, it's a delicate thing. GMing is not easy. I'll have to say that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, literally you took a crack at it. I think, you did twice.
Yeah, I did it twice.
You did what? Do you remember? You recall you did the Winds of Change adventure at a convention,
mm-hmm.
and that was your first GM
mm-hmm.
experience. And then you began a bit of was the Edge of Night.
I don't remember. That sounds like it could be right. The second one.
So how did that go?
Yeah, I found it really difficult, and I actually realized I prefer to just play and kind of be like led around in the story world and just, you know, wreak my own havoc, I guess. But yeah, you're juggling a lot as a GM. I completely got that. And I mean, I also did it when I was really, really new to the whole concept of it too. So I think that's why it was extra hard.
But I mean, given that Aaron here is he's doing it for the first time, and we've all have long since lost our opportunity to try it fresh. You know, what you had some guidance going into it. You had some preconceived notions going into it. What did, and you had also some solid structure of how to tell a story from a traditional mm-hmm. literary perspective.
Mm-hmm.
What advice do you think you have for somebody who's going to try this for the first time?
I would say just do your best to keep things moving along. That's when I had the most fun, when all the characters were just kind of naturally just moving and making things happen. And I was kind of just like in the background, kind of pushing them onward. That's when I started to relax and felt like, you know, the things were developing the way I wanted them to. But as soon as I started stepping in more and kind of like forcing it more, that's when I felt like the game kind of, I don't know, became a little static. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, that's actually kind of comes to a good point or relates to a good point in GMing. I think maybe a GMing golden rule is that something is better than nothing. So mm-hmm. It's much better to kind of even, you should do your best not to make it feel out of place and contrived, but even if you just have to kind of like throw some drama at the characters just so that they're not sitting around, you know, on their thumbs and, you know, like wondering what to do next. It's always a good idea to have some kind of like spares.
Even if just the bedpan gets thrown out, you know, yeah. in front of them or whatever, just to create yeah. something.
I mean, everybody's favorite thing is an orc bust down the door and
yeah.
something
yeah.
has to be done about
Ninjas.
It.
Ninjas!
You know, the one thing I keep coming back to is that an inexperienced GM is a tough thing for a group to handle. And it's not impossible to play. And I don't mean this in a negative way, really, but just an inexperienced player can be just as difficult or need just as much prodding.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm getting at, though, is that it is both the players and the GM's responsibility to drive the story, not just the GM.
Yeah, I think
the GM should be able to facilitate or help push the players along, but the GM should roll with what the players want to do, kind of like one of your earlier points, Jordan.
Well, yeah, that would be one of my top points for a new GM would be communication. I mean, you got to let them know that you're new and shaky at this, and you got to, like, it is a team-building exercise, role-playing. Basically, you have to work together.
So I think one last bit of advice I would have while we're talking about this, what's most important to storytelling is to keep things moving and don't get hung up on the rules, or if you're doing something right, skip it, move on, look it up later after the game. Because I feel very, very adamantly that a lull in the game where you stop to look up something in a book completely destroys whatever momentum you've built to that point. And it pulls everybody immediately out of the scenario. So if you have to just call a rule or make it up on the go, just do it, make it work. People will tell you did it wrong afterwards, whatever. You learn from it, and in your next session, do it correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all just human. Everyone makes mistakes, so don't try to play the game thinking you're not going to.
And don't put too much on your plate either. You don't want to like pile up a whole bunch of stuff and then get caught juggling too many things. Just I'd say take it easy, make it simple, and communicate with your players.
Yeah, Warhammer 3rd actually does some good things toward that end. You know, about like how there's not a whole lot of specific tiny little rules for this, that, and the other. It basically, you know, the game just says, hey, if you think there's an advantage in this situation, just throw some white dice at the player. If you think there's a disadvantage, throw some black dice, you know.
Exactly.
Just makes it easy.
All right, cool. And then the other question that I kind of wanted to discuss was, players aside, how important is the actual character development to each of the GMs? And do you think that having elaborate stories for each of the characters, do you think that benefits the game?
As a game master, I think having players who engage in that aspect of the game and create really deep backstories is really helpful, especially if you communicate with your players, because it allows you to have things to grab and pull from to create story and create motivation in those players. So personally, I think that it's a really good thing, but not every player. Some players want to just be the dwarf who kicks the door and smashes things with a hammer. And other people.
Boy, we don't know them at all, do we?
and that's good. That's all good and fun, you know. But I mean, personally, I like to try to have deeper characters, but I only really do that when I know I'm going to be in a game for the long haul. When it doesn't seem like it's going to continue on, it just seems kind of pointless to create elaborate backstories for guys. But as the experience goes on, I definitely think it's really important to have the characters or the players build their character stories for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I think there's always kind of some balance there, and it depends on the individual players, because some players are the types that they show up with, you know, the 8-page, you know, pre-written, you know, treatment that they bring to you the first game session. And then there's some people, you know, like Lester said, that basically show up and they say, all right, so when do we start rolling dice?
Yeah, I got a 5 on strength. Let's roll some dice.
Yeah,
I mean, when I was, I found when I was first beginning, I really struggled with why do I care about a backstory, and sort of felt like my adventures that I was playing in would create my story. Right. But as I've GM'd more, have realized the need for, character motivation and background to give your adventure is a little bit more substance to tie them together. So it's not so much the single adventure you're in, but it's the glue that holds a series of adventures together.
Yeah, and it's all about being able to have that paragraph to give your character motivation, for sure, because that also colors your characters. You'll find that if you don't create backstories for your characters, as you create more and more characters, you essentially just create the same character and it becomes numbers on a sheet.
So we'll give an example of a bad character backstory or a stale one that doesn't really benefit anybody, because I can think of a couple off the top of my head, and I have a feeling when we just say make a backstory that you're not going to get very far. I mean, what am I doing asking for a bad one? Give me some pitfalls of where somebody might stumble into on generating a backstory that's ineffective.
I have amnesia and I know nothing about my past. Period. And that happened to me with a player who he no longer plays with me, because he was just like, well, I don't know, make a character for me. And that just it bugs me when a player doesn't want to engage the situation, because like we've been saying, it's a community effort. And if somebody is there, you're only as strong as your weakest link. If you have somebody there who's, you know, playing on their phone and not paying any attention, doesn't care about their character at all, it just kind of brings the whole experience down.
No, like you could, and I, one example that I was thinking of is, you know, something I've probably done in the past where, oh yeah, you know, I'm from such and such town, from, you know, some far off place. And I, you know, that's almost the extent of it. You say where you're from, you have some family members, you used to work as this profession, the end. That sort of sounds just fine, but there's nothing usable there in a game. And that's kind of the key I want to hit on with this backstory thing, is that you're not making the backstory to give your guy a backstory. That's not the point. The point is to make a backstory to give the GM and the other players tools to build future stories off of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the irony of creating, you know, by creating a history for your character, you're actually creating a future for them.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And so we just went through this example because Layla's new character, Ella, is going to be joining in Michael Wilson's game at the beginning of February. So tell us a little bit about what you did to make that character both have an engaging backstory, but also, like Jordan just said, create her what is ultimately going to be her future.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we started the same place that we started with Helga too, which is kind of just picking out where she was from. But the difference is that's kind of where we stopped with Helga. We were just like, okay, well, Helga's from Kislev and she's got to go. And all right, the end, like send her off, you know. But with Ella, not only did we pick a location for her.
Before we get into that, the first thing Michael did to kind of throw a wrench at you was he chose your three careers and you got to pick one.
He did. I mean, it just so happened that I had already picked the career that he ended up, like one of the ones that he ended up throwing at me. So that was kind of convenient, but she's an apothecary, which I am excited about all by itself.
I have one of those.
So she's a healer. And then, you know, then we decided that she'd be from the Border Princess, which is kind of interesting too, since it's kind of a free for all down there. Mm-hmm. And this way I don't have to kind of keep track of any particular characteristics she might have, because I didn't really know much about Kislev anyway. And so, you know, Helga's from Kislev, and I'm like, well, that's pretty much all I know.
I just naturally figured being Russian, you would instantly bond with Kislev.
But I mean, in a sense,
Helga,
yes.
Helga smash.
Right. There has been some of that going on in the games for sure. But, you know, now, and then we went ahead and developed a whole backstory for Ella, and she's got a dad who's in love with another apothecary, and they're on a run from a witch hunter, and now Ella's like on their trail trying to save them. And so that's how, you know, in following them through the empire, that's how she ends up at the current adventure that she's going to start with. So already she's kind of got reasons, I guess, for being alive to begin with.
See, that's
and it gives her reason to travel across the empire. It gives her, she's chasing people, which means ultimately in some story she might reach them, but also it created a villain because the witch hunter is chasing her family, who she now is conflicted to get in between the law to save her family. We've also got this, you know, why is the witch hunter chasing these people? And none of this has anything to do with the adventure we're playing in, but what it does is it gives Michael all these tools of NPCs and people to insert into his game to give you recognizable characters to meet.
Exactly.
And he also had me choose torments and what was the other word? Distinctions?
And distinctions. That's something Michael does specifically for his. Mm-hmm. And can you explain a little bit of what you did with those?
Yeah, I thought those were super interesting.
This is kind of a house rule that Michael has incorporated into his games. And what do they kind of do for your character? What don't they do?
I mean, essentially the torments kind of even more so set up motivation for the character, because they were questions like, if I remember correctly, you know, like what's your character most afraid of? What's your character's ambition? And I mean, they were all pretty fairly abstract concepts, you know, like my character's ambition is to, you know, heal the most challenging ailments. And what she's most afraid of is death. And so I found that really stimulating for some reason on just like a more abstract storytelling level. Mm-hmm. And then the distinctions were, I think that's the word, right?
I believe so.
Were things like, in a phrase kind of, encapsulate what your character is all about. So it could be like, organization is number one, or, you know, like my character smells pretty as a flower, things like that. And so, the GM is going to use those to kind of, you know, put that character, I suppose, in a certain place in his own mind.
Not to mention, it makes you commit to how your character might act in a situation, as opposed to just being you as a person. You're maybe now reacting very, very differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's kind of interesting with those torments and distinctions or whatever.
Yeah. I think what he does is actually from a game mechanics perspective, anytime you're able as a player to utilize them, mm-hmm. you get like fortune points or something. Yeah. So like if you trigger one of your negative effects, mm-hmm. you know, like you've basically voluntarily suffering some negative role playing effect due to this thing you've suffer from, mm-hmm. you know, you can gain some fortune dice or
That's kind of interesting. Like, it sounds familiar. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with any of the Fate system games like Spirit of the Century or the Dresden Files or anything like that, but one of the core elements of that game is like that, where you create traits for your character that can, you essentially want them to be double-edged swords, because every time they hinder you, you know, you get rewarded with points or whatever, but if you can swing them in your favor, then you can use them for advantages in different scenarios. And one of them, I think, in Dresden Files anyway, it's called your trouble, and everyone is required to have a trouble. So it's something that is usually getting you the short end of the stick.
That's got to be where Michael is getting it from, because he made my character Conrad come up with something. So Conrad's afraid of being alone. Uh-huh. In his backstory, his partner was kidnapped from him in the middle of a uh-huh. grave robbing session, and he was left alone in the graveyard, fend uh-huh. for himself, and got freaked out.
Yeah, I think it was the character that I was playing in Dresden Files. His trouble was he was self conflicted. So his trouble was, I think, called something like never good enough or something, and so it constantly meant that he would be trying to accomplish things, but he would never quite, you know, not all, it wouldn't happen all the time, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, things just wouldn't quite work out the way he wanted them to. And whenever the GM used that against me, he would reward me with some fortune points or whatever.
Yeah, I like to give them fortune points when they role play, like having a bum leg or being diseased in some way, or, you know, but I really do like, when I do more character creation, I'm going to use this expanded character module.
Yeah. Yeah, which was
puts when, a lot of
yeah, because it adds those kind of interests, you know, like even the, I like the, what do they call it, scars or whatever, you know, like character features,
mm-hmm.
and where you can have like, you know, a cleft lip, or you can, you know, have like a cauliflower ear, or like bags under your eyes or something like that. Yeah, and just
you can have crooked teeth or a ruddy complexion. Yeah.
Bad breath or
swagger,
like a musical voice or something like that. Yeah, actually, the apothecary in my game, he has a musical voice.
Interesting.
And he also happens to be like 5 foot and 100 pounds, and his wife is taller and heavier than he is.
Well, she'd have to be. He's like a tiny person.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into the Q&A here. As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on Facebook under Reckless Dice, or hit us up on Twitter at Reckless Dice. So first off, Zobot, he Facebooks us. He says, would love to hear about your thoughts for the print-on-demand or POD expansions for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. So we pretty much touched on that in the news. was there any other thing specific to expansions that we think we're going to be seeing that we didn't mention? I think we covered it pretty good.
I think we touched on all the possibilities of ways they could go with this POD.
I think so too. So. Cool. Well, Daniel Weiss also hits us up on Facebook, and he had a really interesting question, I thought. And it's regarding loot. Actually, two questions. One is loot and advice on beastmen and how to use them. So basically, he'd like to know how to properly, you know, incorporate beastmen into your games. But also, even more interestingly, I think he asks, how do we all handle loot in our games? Then you guys want to touch on the beastmen first?
Just slobber a lot and make them run at your opponents and try to kill them. Like they're not the brightest of.
And then maybe back up one thing. Who, in a nutshell, who are the beastmen?
They are a weird mixture between humans and animals that happened during the first incursion of chaos, where the chaos energy leaked all over the world and mutated a whole bunch of entities, and that's basically what it is. They're like a
so generally spawn speaking, of chaos. they're kind of like a race of goat men.
Exactly. Yes.
And
they come in all different shapes and sizes. Though.
Well, they did in earlier editions. They don't as much anymore. You used to see things like shark heads and alligator heads and things like that. Now they've all kind of formed into those are now kind of mutants. Mm-hmm. Beastmen now are these goat-like humanoids with increasingly they go everything from like a small satyr to a giant minotaur and everything in between.
Centaur type creatures.
Exactly. And generally speaking, they live in the woods in herds, congregating around a herd stone, which is basically a giant phallic altar to the gods. And they go out on raiding parties and steal and slaughter from farms and things like that.
Yeah, so, picture the scene at the beginning of 2001 Space Odyssey. That's kind of what the beastmen do. They chant and then drink blood.
So generally, when I use them in games, I have them as ambushes on the road, meeting them in the forest. A lot of times I have them, they use horns a lot. So you can have them announce their presence or a charge through a big blow of a horn.
Not just horns on their head either. Yeah, like a horn, like the Horn of Gondor horn, right?
Yes, sorry. Yeah, like a musical horn. And you can they're great for ambushes. They're great for, maybe they stole or a peasant or something and you're on a rescue mission to go get them, which would send you to the Herdstone where she's about to be sacrificed. And then you rescue her, and then you have you flee as they try and chase you down through the woods. That's probably a good starting point. They're kind of the generic bad guys that aren't bandits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the generic non-human enemies.
And they are pure evil. There's nothing good about them.
And they worship, like, they have, there are sects, you know, there are Slaaneshi kind of beastmen and stuff like that.
Yeah,
at least as far as the army book is concerned.
They do worship the Chaos Gods. They don't know that they do necessarily. Yeah. They don't really know them as Chaos Gods. They just know that they worship some dark power that gives them things. Yeah. And so there may be different versions of them outside of just a generic one. There may be a generic beastman or one that's influenced by, you know, Slaanesh or something where it's got an extra, you know, boob and it's got beautiful pink skin and smells like roses.
Yeah. The Norse are a lot like that too, where they worship chaos, but they don't necessarily realize that they do.
So, more interestingly though, I think is this loot concept, because most role-playing games from as far back as I can remember, you're supposed as a player, your main goal outside of storytelling is to slaughter every creature you can find because it gives you experience points, no matter how mundane it is, and to loot that corpse 2 seconds after you kill it, hoping that it has an upgrade to your equipment.
And how many
coins and gold?
Yeah.
And
so when you stab a beast man and it dies in a gurgling pool of ichor, and you search its body, it most likely won't have like a satchel full of silver coins. Its armor will probably be rusty and crappy. You know, you might be able to cut its horn off or its ear and get money for it back in the town. But, I mean, I think it's really situational, the loot, right? If you go into a dragon's lair, you're probably going to find better loot than you are.
I think almost every role-playing game I've played has a loot category under what what the monster was. Like, here's a loot table that you'll roll on to tell you what your what your PCs get for killing this creature.
Four rusty and, spears and the dirty underwear.
Right. I mean, Warhammer's like, yeah, you get a couple moldy pieces of bread, a couple copper, and a rusty dagger off that guy.
Yeah, a handful of teeth.
So how do you guys handle the loot or the absence of in Warhammer? Because I almost bypass it completely unless unless it's somebody significant.
Yeah, if you're like sacking the Lord, you're going to get gold. It is all situational from my perspective.
Yeah, maybe it doesn't speak so well of me. I don't. Maybe I'll lose some fans for saying it, but I like keeping my players poor.
Yeah,
I do too.
I like it when they're struggling to, you know, like save up some money so they can make sure they can hire a coach to go take them to the next town. And
As opposed to, bam, I just bought a castle and I bought an army to fill that castle. Yeah. And now we're going to go conquer the empire. Yeah.
So Layla, being somewhat new to role playing, do you find a compulsion to search every body that you kill to see if there's anything new to get?
I don't know that I,
because you're fortunate not to have that instilled into your gaming psyche.
She's like not your amethyst wizard, man. She's not obsessed morbidly with death.
Yeah, well, a lot of I can't say there's a compulsion.
No. I mean, like if you saw a fancy sword that was an upgrade, like you don't have this upgrade concept built into you.
No, definitely not. Many
players
that is
do.
Good. That is awesome. More role players,
but I mean, we're battling that though.
Yeah,
it's true. Everybody is.
Well, it is. It's ingrained in the role-playing consciousness for sure.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think for role-playing, especially a system like this? Is loot in its traditional sense necessary at all?
No.
No.
I cast no vote. I vote no.
I think in every encounter there should be something you can get.
Information can act as loot too, right? Yeah,
information, a little bit of money, never a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of rusty or poor quality equipment. You know, you can describe loot, but not a lot of it should be an upgrade. Yeah. It shouldn't be stuff where you're like filling your satchel full of stuff that you can take back to town and sell.
Yeah, it should seem almost like a burden. You should pick and choose. You know, that's why I like to use encumbrance
too. So then speaking of loot, though, let's take it one step further. Magic items.
Very rare. Extremely rare. Like, I have yet to hand out a magic item in any game of Warhammer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, one I ever did was from Eye for an Eye, which was that hammer.
Oh, I lied, actually, because a guy created a wizard, and wizards automatically get to start with an attuned item. So, yes, there was one magical item in a game.
Well, that attuned items barely qualify, though.
Yeah, exactly. It just helps them with their spell casting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the book that Helga has, is that considered a magical item?
The kind of the chaotic book.
Yeah.
She's got a a sketchbook of a bunch of creatures with and like kind of them exposed with some, you know, mutations and notes, and kind of it was from somebody who had done research on chaos.
Okay.
So it's kind of a magic item, but it's like a. Manual to the dark.
Is it like the Liber Chaotica?
Yeah, it would be a lot like that.
Because either way, I mean, it doesn't really get brought into anything. I just kind of have it in my inventory, so it's kind of useless. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it could be useful if you ever needed to find out information about chaos, you know, to help you on your quest or whatever.
I suppose, although I can't read, so.
Oh, I think that's the main reason we haven't done much with it.
But it's got a lot of pretty pictures in it. I'm sure you can deduce a lot of information.
Yeah.
Yeah, Helga used picture.
Speaking of beastmen, is Helga got a thing for beastmen?
All right, so
no, Helga does not have a thing for beastmen. In fact, I think she's run away from someone several occasions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do. My audio is going out here. Hey Lester, can you hit up this next question? Because I think I'm going to ruin pronouncing his name.
Sohn Sigmar's. Sohn. I'm sorry. I'm terrible with names with thoughts in them. but anyway, great name. And it says, good questions for your episode. Have another one.
Oh, this was from Facebook. This was in. This was following the comment. He liked the previous questions and had some additional ones.
Okay, so here is an additional question from a horribly butchered name, Sohn Sigmar's. How much not RHFRP? Oh, Wolfram. stuff do you use in your groups?
I just have you played Warhammer before, Lester? Or do you not recognize the acronym?
No, I just know that that really irks you when I say Woofrup.
Woofrup? I'm okay with it now. It's grown on me.
It's my chaos dog. Woof. Woofrup. Anyway, sorry. I'm butchering this question, too. How much not Warhammer Fantasy roleplay stuff do you use in your groups? And he's talking about self-made item cards, house rules, and other fan-made stuff. Personally, I like to use a lot of it. I'm a really big fan of the Libra Fanatica stuff. I've got plans to expand some of the game mastery stuff that we've talked about in previous episodes into my game. You know, I think it's really good. How about you guys?
Yeah, we are using the campaign coins, which is working out really well. My friend just bought a whole new batch of those, so now we have enough to actually go around and make change. It's actually interesting when he says house rules, because I looked at my house rules document the other day when I was preparing for my session, and my house rules are now at like 3 pages or something.
Miracle has got like a whole book rolling now.
I have a download.
He's rebuilt the game like exactly how he wants it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not quite that extreme with it, but we definitely have identified, and I'm always about maximizing the experience for my group, and so we've identified some things that we wanted to change around a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Some pretty drastic stuff that I'm sure would probably get me a lot of hate mail, but
I haven't used any self-made item cards or anything like that. If I come up with an item, I usually just note it on a piece of paper as opposed to building a whole card for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm really big just using the stuff that they provide.
I agree.
Because I feel a little conflicted that I've bought all this stuff and then I'm going to go out and make all my own stuff. Yeah. And I really feel compelled until I've used everything they've provided that I shouldn't be going around messing with my own custom stuff.
Yeah. Well, I would really like to see them with the print on demand. Going back to Zwolbot's question, I'd really like to see them expand in that direction, giving out item card and location cards and stuff like that. I think that would be awesome.
So we've got this Tim Rube, and I don't think I pronounced the last name right because it's got a fancy character and more of the double dots for you, Lester.
Yes.
And he questions us from Facebook. He'd like to hear more about handing out loot, which we kind of just covered. And he says, since Warhammer is a low magic setting, I wonder what your thoughts on this topic are. He is very reluctant to giving out bonus weapons or armor, since he feels that PCs have already an edge due to their better actions.
Hey,
he kind of takes that concept one step further, and it's like, well, he kind of like what you were saying, Jordan. You like to keep players cheap and challenge them. He's wondering, how much do you allow your players to become powerhouses?
Yeah, that's kind of a snowballing effect if you let them get too far with it, because players are smart. Players are very clever, and they will find ways.
Well, some players are very great.
So you're talking like the min-maxing concept and of a player who is playing his character to become the best
metagame
player, the best structured and damage-dealing character he can create.
Metagaming it, yeah.
Well, not specifically. I was kind of coming at it more from the if you give players too much money angle, because I've had a couple of games, not Warhammer specifically, but I've had a couple of games where, I let kind of under the radar, but I let, a player or two get a bit out of hand in terms of collecting cash, and then they end up finding ways to make even more cash and even more cash. And then, the next thing they're like buying up a company and then, turning it in, turning profits and,
hiring assassins
for everyone,
Yeah. Hiring assassins to go.
They hire clients. NPCs to do all their work for them. And
yeah,
I think ultimately keep magic items very limited and keep your players poor is really good advice.
That was really good synergy between those two questions.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm going to leave, the Q&A section with two last little tidbits for those of you to maybe encourage you to go check out the website. We've got two last emails, which are not so much comments, but more fun little tidbits for people to chew on. Florian Schulz emails, by the way, the artist who makes all this stuff for all the Warhammer 3rd edition stuff,
that's the stuff,
has his own blog. And what he's getting at is the guy who does all the cover art for the boxes.
Jarkin, he also does it for, he's big time in Magic. He
draws a lot of stuff. And in this, so he sends us a link where it talks about his thought process of working through the cover for the Lure of Power and the different prototypes and just kind of the process of engaging with Fantasy Flight Games and their design team and really just kind of going through the artistic process. Really, really interesting article. So I'm going to link to that on the show notes on the website. And there's also in his blog, which is where the article is, you can backtrack quite a bit and see some of the earlier works like he did for Blackfyre Pass and Omens of War and several other ones. His art is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, it's stunning.
And then the second little bonus we're going to give for you guys is a link sent in from Tom Woods. And he kind of to dovetail off of our character creation content earlier, he made a video about his character's backstory, and we'll link to it. And I think he did an absolutely fantastic job of coming up with an interesting backstory for his character, but also with a wonderful twist at the end. So I do encourage you guys to go and check it out. I think it's anybody who enjoys Warhammer will get a great kick out of it. So with that, thank you guys for listening. We'll wrap it up for this episode of The Reckless Dice. We'll be back in about 2 weeks with our next episode. Be sure to comment on the site, recklessdice.com, or shoot us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Till next time, thanks for listening.
Happy gaming.
Bye, guys.
Because it's better when the
woman's good.
Maybe.